Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns. I'm recording this wee podcast towards the end of June in 2020 from my home in Scotland. I record this podcast mostly for the sort of outdoor community in Scotland, but they get listened to all over the world, I'm surprised and rather flattered to say. We're in lockdown now. We've been in lockdown for, feels like a long, long time now. And so in common with a lot of people, I've been sort of missing the hills and missing getting out. And I have to say that in lockdown, life's pretty dull. But I keep myself entertained. And to be fair, you know, if my life is dull, all right, the sort of things that excite me, the things that I like doing into getting into the mountains, I can't do. But there's a lot of people who, you know, they're having it a lot worse than me. Maybe their livelihoods are threatened, or maybe they're NHS or frontline workers, or they're sick themselves, or they're worried about someone who's sick, you know. And I guess those people would, they'd be pretty happy with dull, you know. They'd kind of look forward to dull. So I'm just digging in like everybody else, and I'm waiting for all this to be over. One of the things I've been doing, I've been reading outdoor books, and one of the ones I want to talk about, I'm going to read a little sample later on of The Bond by Simon McCartney, and Simon and I are going to hopefully get together fairly soon, and I'm going to talk to him about his life and the climbs that he writes about. The Bond, I have to say, is an exceptional book. I actually am not a big reader of mountaineering books. But I found the Bond pretty gripping, to be honest. It talks about two climbs, principally features two climbs, both in Alaska, one on Mount Huntington and one on Denali. Now, the word climb doesn't really cover these ascents. They were, I think, battles for survival, battles against starvation, about the cold, against the sheer danger of the place. You know, and it's a difficult book to put down. So I would really recommend The Bond. And it's, I won't give away too much. I thought the best thing to do is I'll read you a short sample. This is taken from the climb on Mount Huntington, which I have to say, sounds like one of the most terrifying climbs anybody's ever done. People say my books inspire them to get into the outdoors. But I must confess that I was reading Simon's book and thinking, thank God that's not me. Here is an extract from Simon's climb on Mount Huntington. I can hardly see as I follow Jack's lead. We want to run and hide, but are slowed down by the steepening ice and the fact that we must pause to place ice screws in case the sliding snow causes one of us to fall. I reach Jack, and he passes me the rack without comment or delay, like a relay runner passing the baton. I shoulder the little sling of equipment and move on without a pause. From the photo we had studied, we believe that we should run into some patchy rock outcrop soon. We may be in luck. When I'm 80 feet above Jack's belay, I see a small black rock looming above me. I'm going for that rock above us. Okay, man, go, go. Snow is running down the face all around me now. I need to be methodical in my haste, and I belt in one of the drive-in ice screws to protect against a fall. I must not lose my head. If I get knocked off in a slow slide, I doubt Jack's anchors will hold and we will both be killed. Jack can only watch forlornly, wiping snow from his goggles. I reach the little rocky island, and the disappointment is crushing. It only sticks out above the ice by a foot and a half. This is not enough to protect us. But it is too late to look elsewhere. Snow slides are beginning to pour down the slope, and our situation is becoming tenuous. We could be swept away any minute. I chop out a stance and place one long ice screw and two pins, one of which looks good, thank heavens. Safe! I shout, and instantly the irony of that climbing call occurs to me. At least with a solid anchor we can fight back, but we are anything but safe. Come on, Jack! I take stock while he cleans his anchor. We are still not high enough to avoid the debris that I expect to come flying out of the runnels at any time now. I can almost get my shoulder under the rock, but the drifting snow pulls at my head and pack. The rock is parting the wave of sliding snow for me, but not so for poor Jack. For him, it is a deluge. He must climb on a moving conveyor belt of snow. I keep him on a very tight rope to help his morale as much as to prevent a fall. When he reaches the ice screw I have used for a runner, I tell him to leave it. It will take too long to remove. He unclips the carabiner, leaves it on the rope above his harness, and keeps moving upwards. He is about 50 feet below me when there is a ghastly noise from above. It sounds like concrete being poured from a great height. I have heard this sound before. Jack, watch out! I hunch on my stance and brace myself, ready to take as much of his weight with my body as possible before the anchors are loaded. I have just enough time to see him look up. He acts instinctively, and with two mighty wallops he buries the picks of his axes in the ice above him and lowers his head. Thump! This snowslide is much bigger. It bursts over the rock and over my head, and I lose sight of Jack. The rope goes heavy almost at once. I take Jack's entire weight and then some more. Through the tension in the rope, I can feel the snow pummeling him for perhaps 10 or 15 seconds. I cannot see. And then the angry white snake of snow is gone, off into the void below. And there is Jack, knocked off his feet, but hanging by the wrist loops that we always attach to our ice tools. The front points of his crampons are no longer in, and his head is on the ice. He is not moving, and dreadful thoughts race through my mind. Hey, Jack! Jack! You okay? Talk to me! It is only a few seconds or so before he moves, but it seems like an age. Come up! Come on! He moves his head and looks up blankly as he slowly heaves himself back onto his front points, and I am released from his weight. There is a pause while he gathers himself, and then, without saying a word, he starts to climb like a machine. His face is blank. He is climbing on instinct. The impact of the snow had briefly knocked him senseless, but his eyes are wide open. After a few moves, he unleashes a tirade of the worst language I have ever heard. He is obviously shaken, but getting mad helps him. On his way to me, I see that he is using his picks like weapons, stabbing at the mountain, as if exacting revenge. Despite the near-death experience, he is cogent when he joins me. He takes a good look at the anchors I have arranged. This is a huge boost to my morale. He is checking my work, and so has his head on. Despite the chaos of our situation, he is thinking instinctively, like the instinctive climber he is. We need a hole to hide in immediately, and we shall have to create it. Like soldiers caught in an ambush, we need to dig in. The most expedient way to do this is for me to belay him while he chops away under the rock. This way, he can move freely while I protect him with the rope. We are in great luck. The rock itself is undercut, and the ice underneath must have formed from wind-blown snow rather than water ice, and is formed from big, fragile ice crystals that shatter easily. The surface has a dense skin, but once the first foot has been cut away, it is quick to excavate. Soon, Jack is out of the firing line, and the adrenaline is abating. I am proud of us. We had just dealt with a potentially lethal situation, without complaint or discussion. We are well enough hidden that the mountain's endless supply of ammunition can harm us no more. But we are pinned down again, and we need to be more comfortable than this. We need to be able to get warm and prepare food and liquids. We may not get swept away, but we may yet fade away. We cannot sit cringing under this rock for long.